Hello everyone. Thanks so much for joining Ukrainian Spaces live edition this week. We're back, and this is very important for us to see how you guys keep coming back, how you guys keep amplifying Ukrainian Spaces both live and as recorded podcast, because it means that more Ukrainian voices can be amplified. More Ukrainian conversations can be decolonized, and there is no such thing as Ukrainian fatigue. It's as though like people who would love to for us to stop talking about Ukraine, this is what they're dreaming about, but in reality this is not what the majority of people want. So it warms my heart to see many people joining our live broadcast as well as our recorded sessions, and they listen to them as well. Valeria,
I was just going to say that even more people listen as well in their own time, which is amazing to see that our broadcasts and our podcast reaches people beyond just people who hang out on Twitter, which I also love the people who hang out on Twitter because we are them. But yeah, just grateful to everyone listening to us in their spare time.
Absolutely. And we started trending in places like Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and even Singapore and across Global South, which when we started the second season some time ago, is exactly the thing that we would hope to happen. And it is happening, but also it's happening thanks to our Patreon sponsors. All our job on Ukrainian Spaces is possible because of you and your growing support. So if you are not our Patreon sponsor, please consider joining. You can find all the information at ukrainianspaces.com, and you get a lot of extra bonus content, a lot of perks, including asking your own questions to our featured Ukrainians and featured Ukrainian allies in person during live broadcast. Anyhow, yep. Valeria, how are you?
It's been, I think, in the world of Ukraine and in the world in general, it's been quite a intense couple of weeks and like massive ups and downs from, you know, liberation of Kherson and Friday to, you know, whatever is happening at the moment and all the massive attacks, all the desperate massive attacks that Russia has launched on Ukraine, because that's clearly the only way that they know how to respond to losing. It's just been, yeah, and to obviously all of our friends and our listeners and Alexandra as well and people who are in Ukraine right now, like the blackouts and the power outages are just getting worse and worse. And we spoke about this before, Maxim, as well. But it's just, yeah, the closer we're getting to winter, the more stark this reality is becoming. So for those of you who are listening, I think it's just remember, like, it's important to remember this in a lot of contexts. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you got to time your life now to blackout, and they can come, you know, emergency blackout and scheduled ones. So lots of people started getting energy only for several hours a day. Real story, my mom, you know, the washing cycle of her washing machine is keep going on for 2 days now because it cannot just, you know, complete because of all the blackouts that are happening regularly. I mean, this is just a random illustration, but kind of what can bring home for a lot of you the reality of what it's like to live in 2022 amid war-induced blackouts. So, yeah.
Before we ask our guests to introduce themselves, I just wanted to remind everyone what we're here to do, because I think it's important sometimes to bring it back to the goal of our podcast and in general a lot of the work that we do. But you know, I repeat this almost every single time, but, you know, we were a lot more than right now, but right now is a little bit better. We're seeing loads of people who are not Ukrainian talk about Ukraine, a lot of Russia experts talk about Ukraine. And this essentially led to a lot of, I guess, misinformation, misleading kind of narratives, false narratives, outdated narratives on Ukraine. So we really believe that it's important to elevate Ukrainian voices to be able to decolonize conversations about Ukraine, which is what we're doing here today. But just as Maxim always says, we have one golden rule, and that is for our Ukrainian guests to introduce themselves. And today we welcome Oleksandra. Many of you follow all the incredible threads that she does, but please, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself a little bit further to our audience today.
Hey, everyone, and I'd like to say thank you to our wonderful hosts for the amazing work that they're doing. I think that, you know, the Ukrainian Spaces was like one of the first podcasts and one of the first really spaces for Ukrainians and Ukrainian voices to be amplified. Because, you know, we're still getting drowned out in the conversation. And it is, you know, it's horribly unpleasant just to see all of this. But the good work of people like you is really what, you know, what keeps me going and what gives me hope. So for those of you who don't know me or might be following me but don't know anything about who I am and why you're even listening to me, because, you know, I'm not really a political expert or a wartime commentator or any of those things. I used to study sociology and then journalism, and I spent most of my adult life, most of my career writing about movies, about pop culture, and sort of, you know, trying to shine a little light on the topics that a lot of us still deem a little, you know, unserious, sort of frivolous. I used to write about fashion and about how, you know, fashion is actually a sort of a representation of what's going on in society a lot of the time. So I would try to find topics which people around me sort of thought were not as serious as I saw them to be. And I try to, you know, explain to people why things like this are important, why, you know, why fashion isn't just about looking pretty, or why, you know, why feminism is important, which for an Ukrainian audience back in the day was important and sort of a new subject. And so I did a lot of these things, but I never thought that, you know, one day I'd end up talking about a war happening in Ukraine, and the sort of subject that was deemed unserious would be, you know, my country's history and, you know, my country's culture. So today I mostly try and amplify these ideas to foreigners, to anyone who'll pretty much listen. A couple of weeks, I think, before the full-blown war started, I started a TikTok account. And don't judge me, I have a younger sister-in-law who's 19, and she dragged me into that world. But I just saw so many silly narratives, you know, so many... I saw that, you know, if you were to... you know, to search for Ukraine on TikTok back then, you'd probably find, you know, videos of American teenagers saying about how, you know, how Vladimir Putin was daddy, or how they didn't want to live through World War III, or things like that. And I noticed that, you know, there was this huge, huge lack of Ukrainian voices in the conversation. I tried unsuccessfully to do the things that I'm doing now on Twitter, to do them on TikTok, because TikTok is still a very, very toxic environment, and it's not for those faint of heart. It is difficult to, as a Ukrainian content creator, do something on TikTok and not, you know, have to cry for a couple of hours because you're getting so many mean comments. So I switched to Twitter, and Twitter is much nicer. We have so much support, so many people. And this is honestly, like, I'm always skeptical of, you know, of the role that social media plays in our mental health, in our daily lives. But throughout this war, the community of people who are not Ukrainian by birth, or who don't live in Ukraine, or who, you know, who might not have heard about Ukraine before, you know, the full-scale war started, but are supporting it and, you know, and have become like friends, like family, That has been one of the, you know, the highlights, one of the good things, one of the things that are keeping us sane. Yeah. So that's who I am, I guess.
Absolutely. I agree. I think sometimes people get really surprised to hear such good things, you know, said about Twitter or, you know, any social media platforms, because of all the toxicity that lives there. But this is the platform, these are platforms that help us to spread the word. And this is a responsibility I think every Ukrainian takes very seriously these days, and try to coin those platforms and spread the truth and their stories. But Alexander, I mean, I think one thing that I super appreciate about you, first and foremost, you're in Ukraine, you're in Kyiv, you're with your family, you're living that horror every day, yet you find every day some strength and some focus to still explain lots of things to foreigners about Ukraine. And second thing that I even more appreciate about you, that when I first started reading you and came across your beautifully written, fantastic threads on so many topics, I think this is one of the reasons why I was so excited, because for many years it felt very isolating and lonely. Mm-hmm. That I thought, like, okay, if I look at my experience of coming into my Ukrainianness through colonial lenses, if I feel like my culture is being, oftentimes appropriated, distorted, and erased by Russia, is it something, is just me, or is it something that other people see? And when I started reading you, it was such an aha moment. Like, yes, of course, finally, I can also see people who also see the same things and they, you know, feel the same about it. So this is my very long way to come to the question, like, when was the moment for you to realize that we should be looking at what is happening to our culture and our identities, specifically through the lens of colonialism, which is, you know, sometimes perceived as very heavy and very intellectual term?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you for all the really kind words. It's lovely, and I'm sitting here blushing like an idiot. But I do know how you feel, absolutely, because, you know, for a while I felt like I was going insane, because, you know, as someone who got my bachelor's degree in sociology, obviously I had studied all of this in theory, you know, colonialism and cultural appropriation and things like that. But funnily enough, even in one of the best universities in Ukraine, I still love my university and I'm very proud of having studied there. But, you know, even in a university that's very pro-Ukrainian, that's very sort of, you know, focused on Ukrainian history and traditions and things like that, and heritage, nobody, you know, none of our professors, openly at least, none of them really talked about, you know, how Ukraine is a post-colonial country, how our traditions have been stolen. You know, when we talk about cultural appropriation, we talk about, you know, important, very important examples, obviously, such as white people in the US wearing dreadlocks or things like that. And obviously, you know, these are very important things to talk about. But we never mentioned the things that, you know, that a lot of, I think, my classmates would have recognized as something that has happened in our society and something that is happening. And so one day, you know, obviously I was trying to explain all these new ideas, because, you know, as someone who's a freshman or a second year student in university, and you learn about all of these new theoretical frames and all these ideas and all this, you know, this framework, and you start telling people about it, you know, you start telling your parents or your boyfriend or whatever. And, you know, I was telling, I think, my mom about how, you know, how cultural appropriation is awful and bad. And, you know, like many Ukrainians who weren't really familiar with the topic, she was like, well, you know, I think this is like something that people in the West do because they have too much time on their hands. And I was like, well, mom, but, you know, if say Russians started selling borscht in Russian restaurants abroad and saying that, you know, it's theirs, you wouldn't like it, you'd be offended. And she said, well, yes, I wouldn't be, but also that's what they're already doing. And we just sat in silence and thought about how, you know, it is already happening.
But it's also a journey, I think, for many Ukrainians as well, to figure out sometimes what part of your culture, customs, your own family history, or your own vision of yourself is being shaped by colonialism and what is true. It goes to this really bizarre kind of paranoid, I would say bipolar moment where you're trying to decolonize your own, yourself as a Ukrainian, and you're not entirely even sure what is true, what is not, what was conditioned, what was, real. You know what I mean, guys?
Yeah. No, for sure. I think, you know, what helps me personally is when I speak to other Ukrainians and I figure out that some of our experiences were similar. That's when it kind of like light bulb moment happens in my head that I all of a sudden realize, okay, like, I don't know. I mean, you tell me always, this is the most simple example, but even like with language, right? Like a lot of language things, not just necessarily culture, but language in particular, like the only reason I think a lot of us who are Russian speak, were educated Russian speaking in Ukraine, realize that it's actually as a consequence, they're a consequence of, you know, the practices of Russian colonial Ukraine, that we were the way we were and our families were the way we were. And I think if we didn't speak to each other, we wouldn't have arrived to those conclusions in the same way that we did, basically. So, yeah, I don't know. But Alexandra, I know you said briefly, and this is a topic that interests me a lot in general, but and I know you've been covering so many different topics since you joined Twitter in terms of bringing people awareness about different topics. But I was wondering, and I asked a couple of our other guests before about this as well, but what has been some of your sort of, I guess, I say highest performing threads or posts, but that just shows, like, what have audiences been the most interested in out of all the things that you've been speaking about online?
Oh, that's a good question. And I'm not sure I'll be able to answer very precisely because, you know, whenever a thread gets sort of out of my bubble, I tend to mute it because, you know, I do get a lot of not very friendly comments from tankies and the like. But I do think one of the sort of threads that I got the most feedback on was a thread about the life of the LGBT community in the USSR. And a lot of people were, you know, shocked because, you know, they genuinely thought that, you know, the USSR was Soviet and leftist, and, you know, therefore they, you know, they had to respect the human rights and things like that. And I was shocked at, you know, how differently, you know, Westerners who'd never lived that experience or never heard firsthand accounts from it about it, you know, how they sort of had an absolutely different picture in their minds. And that was, you know, sort of a rude awakening for me because I thought, you know, these things were, you know, common knowledge.
I think that part of the problem, including with cultural appropriation and lots of things that Russia stole, specific from very rich, very ancient Ukrainian culture, and how it's now to the date is perceived abroad as something like as Russian, Russian painter Malevich, who was like Ukrainian, who considered his art integrally Ukrainian and whatnot. It's part of the reason for that is because of this image of that Russians would project and Russian colonial empire would project abroad was the only way and the only information that foreigners would get. Like they would always see Russia through the lenses of Moscow, and they would always see Russian colonies through the lenses of Moscow. So we, up until now, didn't have a chance even to tell our own story. But in that regard, I'm curious to ask you if you see that these things are changing in any way, and when you do point out to people how this practice of cultural appropriation, which is, you know, very integrally colonial and didn't happen just with Russia but many other colonial empires, how it's falling apart, but what kind of examples do you bring to people, you know, apart from Borscht, of course, or something that really could speak to anyone? And I think this is a very important question for other Ukrainians as well to pick up.
You know, except for Borscht, I often think about Salo. Even nowadays, if you get into a sort of an argument with a Russian online, the chances are Now, if they know you're Ukrainian, they will, you know, sort of make some kind of joke about salo or things like that, you know. And yet, I conducted a little experiment. I went online and I picked out the sort of the best rated Russian restaurants all over the world. I think about 80% of them, they serve salo as a Russian dish. So I thought, you know, this is crazy because on one hand, Russians associate Ukrainians with eating salo and they mock us for it. And, you know, they see it as some kind of proof that we are silly villagers. And yet in their sort of Michelin-starred restaurants all over Europe and all over the US, they serve salo. You know, it's unfair. It's crazy. And, you know, nobody bats an eyelash at it because, you know, when I was writing an article about it, I noticed that nobody was criticizing Russia for cultural appropriation. Instead, I found an article in which the author, she openly said that, you know, oh, well, you know, Russian cuisine isn't actually just, you know, dishes created by ethnic Russians or whatever. They have, you know, elements of Ukrainian cuisine in there and Georgian cuisine and, you know, Chinese cuisine. And she wrote on about this as if this was some sort of very positive example of how a culture can sort of, you know, use elements from other cultures in a respectful way. But I thought, you know, does this person know anything about the history of Russia? You know, none of this was taken in a respectful manner. None of this, you know, was calmly just taken from nations that were seen as equals. You know, this wasn't some sort of cultural exchange. No, this was stolen. And yet here we have, you know, writers, food writers, in very respectable sort of Western outlets writing about how this is actually a good thing. I did stay up at night thinking about that for quite a long time because it just drove me so angry and so mad. It was really annoying. I think it is very sad that whenever, you know, you try and write something about, you know, Russian colonialism and you obviously, you know, you go online looking for academic resources on that. You know, you think, you know, there have to be articles and things like that because, you know, they're serious articles about, you know, the influence of Beyoncé on modern media or French cuisine on, you know, on the American presidency or whatever. You know, you can find articles, you know, on the most niche, weird topics imaginable. And yet, whenever you try to find information and, you know, just lay some kind of, you know, theoretical groundwork or an article about Russian colonialism, it's very difficult to find anything, you know, because a lot of people who are studying colonialism, they're not even sure if, you know, if Russia was colonial, because they don't, you know, because this sort of, the examples of colonialism when, you know, when both the colonizers and the oppressed are usually white, you know, this doesn't get studied much because, you know, it hasn't been spoken up about. And you know, it's still a theoretically sort of questionable idea. But, you know, I think that I hope that after this, you know, more people will be writing about this, more people will be studying history, more people will be looking back into it because, you know, we can't just have Timothy Snyder and Applebaum. You know, we need more people here.
And we need the Ukrainian voices first.
Yes. I was just going to say that we'll probably have a whole episode on this with Maxim, but essentially, I mean, in the West, at least, I mean, in English-speaking places, people are slowly, as you said, like Timothy Snyder and so on, have been developing this topic and awareness and this lens of looking at Ukraine through, like, colonialism and so on. But I think there's also a lot of work to be done in countries that have experienced Russian colonialism themselves as well.
I was actually in this, you know, worldwide known gallery in Moscow, Tretyakovsky Gallery, which is always paraded by Russian propaganda as this vault of famous Russian culture and arts. And when you go inside, it's basically gives you the same creepy vibe that you know, British Museum would give, because there is everything there. There are Ukrainian, Kazakh, Kyrgyz, African art, everything that they managed to stole from everywhere. They don't, and you know, it has a lot of mentions that it's so-called Russian art, although names do not check out, and places where those people made that art are not Russian. And then yet people outside the world perceive this as a vault of Russian culture, where in fact it's just a vault of stolen loot, of art loot that they just brought from somewhere else and then labeled Russian. And I would love to see the same conversation that we now have about these famous museums in the UK, in Germany, in France, and the conversations about returning the art to the places where it was stolen, or at least marking it as a stolen art. And I think that's the ultimate goal for this conversation about decolonizing.
But Alexander, I actually wanted to ask you, these conversations that we're having online, like with each other, with our followers, how are these conversations as well around appropriation, about colonialism, about imperialism of Russia being had in Ukraine as well right now? Because I know, of course, people have way more important daily survival things to care about, but I was just wondering whether people have been discussing this from this perspective now as well.
I think so. I have been seeing some of this, a little bit more of this online. But, you know, I think a lot of the time Ukrainians, they really refuse to see themselves as victims in any situation because, you know, they, for some reason, they feel like this makes them look weak. So whenever I bring up a lot of these topics, there's always a little, you know, suspicion that, you know, is this going to make us look weak historically? You know, because we're fighters, we're not victims, you know, we don't want to be pitied. So I think a lot of the pushback, it comes from, you know, the desire of Ukrainians to be seen as, you know, winners in all situations and not someone who, you know, was robbed of their cultural identity. But I do think that a lot more of these conversations are happening. And, you know, to give you an example, a couple of years back, I was lucky enough to be present at the Odessa Film Festival, which, you know, I love. It's a wonderful event. But there was a weird sort of situation because they usually have this, you know, special screening of a historically significant or hard to see movie. And the movie that they were showing was this silent picture from the 30s, which I think, I'm not sure if it was an adaptation of Taras Bulba or it was, you know, something else, but it was, you know, it was set in Ukraine among the Cossacks. And, you know, and funnily enough, oh, no, I remember now, it was, I think it was an adaptation of a short story by Hohl. And funnily enough, the movie, which was made in Hollywood in the 30s, they sort of portrayed Ukrainians as these sort of savage brutes. And, you know, the Russians, which were visiting the village, they were shown as, you know, very sort of sophisticated, suave gentlemen. And, you know, turns out, I did a little research, and it turns out that, you know, the dancers who were portraying the Ukrainians, they were obviously all Russian. And, you know, and it was just such a weird example of you know, of pretty much, I don't know, brown face, Ukrainian face. I don't know what the term for this could be, but it was obviously something was wrong about, you know, making a movie with Russians playing stupid, you know, savage Ukrainians and, you know, selling it to a Western audience. So today, at least, I can't really imagine a film like that being shown to, you know, general applause. Because, you know, when it was shown back then, I think it was 2018 or 2019, everybody, you know, everybody was quite happy with it. You know, they just said, oh, well, you know, it's nice that Hollywood back in the 30s, that they made a movie about us. Although the movie obviously portrayed Ukrainians in absolutely horrific and sort of derogatory ways. And, you know, so I hope that, you know, today Ukrainians in general would be, you know, sort of more self-aware of, you know, of the portrayal that we are getting.
Yeah. And it's obvious that all these processes, first of all, they would take centuries, and they were also not sometimes black and white and more complex. Like, for example, you cannot say that Russian colonialism would just erase Ukrainian culture or just outright steal something and then just call it Russian and that's it. Like, we had also many various processes, like, for example, with Ukrainian literature, and we talked about it a lot with a lot of other guests, like, for example, examples of Lesya Ukrainka, a famous Ukrainian writer, who was reshaped by Russian colonial propaganda into this, you know, kind of sickly girl who writes romantic poetry and is constantly sick and, you know, completely erasing the body of her work on feminism, on Ukrainian liberation, on democratic traditions. And she was a badass independent woman having views on how to reshape Europe and how to bring down patriarchy way before it became trending in Europe. And the same way, for example, for Taras Shevchenko, who was also celebrated by Russian colonial propaganda as this one allowed Ukrainian writer, but only works that would portray Ukrainians as these uneducated peasants who are, you know, constantly trapped into their almost childish-like situations. These works were allowed, and this kind of portrayal Ukrainians were allowed, but works that would demand decolonization of Ukraine and liberation from Russian rule were not that celebrated. When you look at all these examples in culture, in food, in literature, whatnot, of Russia appropriating Ukrainian culture, making it Russian, or erasing it in the process, do you see any kind of specific playbook of cultural appropriation that Russia uses, might not only for Ukraine, but for other colonized nations? Is there something, specific pattern that you instantly recognize when you see it?
That is a good question. I do think that, you know, something that all of the sort of ethnicities and nations that have been oppressed by Russia, something they have in common is that, you know, if you're, you know, an ethnicity that is non-Russian in the Soviet times, or, you know, in the times of the Russian Empire, then whatever traditions or, you know, cultural food or cultural dances, music, songs, whatever you have, Russians will either mock it, make fun of it, and, you know, treat it as something very quirky and unsophisticated, which is, funnily, isn't the worst thing that could happen, because if they decide that, you know, something isn't embarrassingly quirky, then they'll accept it and treat it as part of their culture and essentially steal it. Because, you know, we've seen this happen among all of the nations that have been oppressed by Russia. I think, you know, they really have sort of two strategies. They can either make fun of you for having, you know, certain traditions, or they can just steal those traditions, make them their own, and, you know, and never mention that these traditions are actually not theirs. Because, you know, I'm thinking, I keep coming back to the topic of Borscht, obviously, and, you know, I just keep thinking, you know, when did it become, you know, sort of a universal Slavic food? I think at the start of the war, I think it was the second day of the war, there was this open letter published by Russian chefs and Russian restaurateurs who wrote that, you know, that they're very sad that a war is happening, and they wrote something, you know, some silly sort of nonsense about how Slavic brothers shouldn't be, you know, fighting over anything, because the best things that we have are common things, such as borscht. And, you know, that was just adding insult to injury, because, you know, even in these sort of situations, when Russians, you know, are trying to acknowledge the fact that they might have committed, you know, mistakes or done something wrong, even then, they're still sort of, you know, trying to actively grab our cultural heritage. And, you know, I was just trying to find out when, you know, when the topic of borscht became so controversial. And, you know, turns out that even Mayakovsky was, you know, in his poems, when he talked about Ukraine, he said that, you know, Russians know, you know, the one thing that they know from Ukraine is that Ukrainians make borscht. And, you know, if this association was so strong back in his day, then, you know, it's very odd to then claim that, you know, borscht is actually Russian. So I think that, you know, it's very weird because there are inconsistencies, even in the very heavily edited version of history that Russia presents itself. There are still inconsistencies, and so many of them that, you know, you can actually see that, you know, their version of events doesn't add up. And I really hope that, you know, that obviously historians will just, you know, try and critically look at Russian history and critically look at what Russia presents as its own culture. Because, you know, it's, we've done that and people are doing that with the British Empire. They're doing it with, you know, every empire that's existed. But somehow the Russian Empire has always sort of escaped scrutiny and has always been treated like it's not really an empire at all.
Yeah, they've invested quite a bit in the fact, like in making sure that that's also the case in the world. So I think the time has come for us to reverse that investment and pay, you know, let them take their money back and tell the world the truth as it is. So yeah, thank you so much, Alexandra. I wanted to ask you, I know we're getting closer to the end of our podcast, and we could talk forever as well about this topic because it's the best and the most important right now, but we have this one question which I'm sure you've heard us asking many times, and I think in the context of our conversation today about, you know, appropriation, about discovering our own identity, culture again in a new way, in a new light since February 24th, I just wanted to ask you if your personal, you know, understanding of what it means to be Ukrainian for you has changed since February 24th or maybe before. But yeah, any thoughts as well on that?
You know, absolutely, because you know, I think like a lot of Ukrainians, a lot of progressive Ukrainians, I had a lot of sort of arguments with my parents about history and about, you know, and about why history was important. And usually those sort of conversations led me to saying, you know, well, history's gone. It's, you know, nobody's going to be attacking Ukraine. You know, why do we hold on to all of that tragedy that's, you know, that's in the past? And, you know, I proclaim myself happily a pacifist. And, you know, I was one of those people who thought that, you know, ending wars is simple. You just have to, you know, stop fighting. And then, you know, after the war started, the full-scale war, I just realized, you know, that history is never really behind us. And, you know, we might not want to study it because it's too tragic. And, you know, we might not want to study Ukrainian songs because they're, again, very tragic. And we might not, you know, understand what our anthem is really about until the moment comes when, you know, it all becomes very, very clear. And, you know, whenever I sort of gotten a renewed interest in Ukrainian literature and all, you know, all of these things that you usually learn in school and you don't really treat very seriously because it's all very tragic and very complicated and very sad. And, you know, but now I just look back at these things and I think, okay, so now I understand why that's important. You know, now I understand that this has been happening for a very, very long time, because, you know, this isn't a war which, you know, which just happened out of nowhere. Because this is, I think, one of the reasons why I really dislike whenever Western journalists, you know, even the most well-meaning ones, they say things like, you know, this is a senseless war. I mean, yes, of course, it is a senseless war on one hand. But on the other hand, for Russia and for Ukraine, it is a war of survival. And it's pretty much the sort of the final chapter, I hope, of a war which has been going on for centuries. And for Russia, it's, you know, it's an attempt to rebuild their sort of empire. And so obviously it might seem senseless when you're looking, you know, at it from the outside. But if you look back at all of our history and, you know, the things that have happened, you think, wow, you know, that's quite a logical continuation of what has been happening. So I think that, you know, as a Ukrainian, I've sort of begrudgingly accepted, you know, the importance of all the tragic things that happened in the past. And I realized that you can never leave the past, you know, in the past, so to speak. It does sort of have a habit of catching up, you know, with you. But I've also sort of realized that, you know, being Ukrainian, I mean, it's not that I ever thought that, you know, being Ukrainian was about ethnicity or whatever, but I've just realized how important it is as a label for yourself, and how, you know, how important it is to identify yourself. Because I think that, you know, in a weird way, a lot of what's happening now should have happened in the 19th century, you know, because whenever people, you know, Westerners, they ask me, you know, like, why, but, you know, why would nationalistic songs be popular in Ukraine? You know, things like that should have stayed in the 19th century. And I mean, I agree. I absolutely agree. Looking up to, you know, controversial historical figures and things like that, it is something that should have stayed in the 19th century. But yet again, you know, Ukraine is, you know, people are trying to destroy Ukraine's statehood now. And these things usually only happen in the 19th century. So what I guess I'm trying to say in a sort of very long-winded way is that I think that what is happening now is something that, you know, historically might have happened earlier. But sadly, you know, we're going through this form, you know, sort of time, very difficult, very challenging time now, for better or for worse. And I think that, you know, this sort of real Ukrainian identity and an identity which will be, you know, important in, you know, in history books in the future is obviously being shaped now. I think another thing that I have realized is, you know, how much of our strength lies in our diversity. Because, and I really hope that, you know, this is something that Ukrainians will actively fight for, you know, metaphorically this time in the future. Because, you know, our strength lies in our differences. You know, I've seen so many people from so many different backgrounds, you know, ethnicities, with you know, hugely different political stances, you know, fighting for Ukraine both on the battlefield and off the battlefield. You know, I've seen people who are anarchists say that, you know, yeah, I'm an anarchist, and generally I don't think that, you know, that nation states are a big deal. I don't, you know, think that's important, but, you know, Russia is trying to murder my friends, my family, my town, and I will defend it. So I think that this, you know, a lot of transformations have happened with Ukrainian identities, because, you know, we're now seeing that people, you know, say, okay, I'm you know, I'm a leftist, I'm an anarchist, but, you know, if trying to protect my country and, you know, not wanting to surrender means that, you know, people from the outside will call me a rabid nationalist, then, you know, I'm still going to do it, because it's, you know, survival is important here, and my community is what's the most important to me. So I do think that this is the formation of new communities, new relationships between the state and people, and between people themselves. And I do hope that we'll manage to, you know, to build a stronger, better, more diverse society based off of that. So that's something that I really hope. And, you know, I'm gearing up to, you know, to be doing work in that sort of field after the victory, because a lot of work will need to be done, but
absolutely.
But we'll do it. Yeah.
Thank you so much. And that's very incredibly smart and incredibly important way to put it. And I think a lot of Ukrainians are also trying to communicate that to the outside world, that what we the identity shaping process that is happening in Ukraine, we see ourselves as Ukrainians, as part of community, how we see our own country, is so much already of forward looking in its vision, that many things, many traditional things, how people the vocabulary that they even used about it in the West and abroad, nationalism, right, left, all this terminology does not really even apply in many situations to the realities of Ukrainians and their quest to preserve but also reshape their identity. So thank you so much for reminding us. Before we close, unfortunately, I'll bring Tatiana for a bit of feedback from our listeners and our supporters. Tatiana, go ahead, please.
Hi, Alexandra and everyone. First of all, speaking of forging new relationships, because of wonderful guests like you, we have so many new patrons, new followers, new listeners, old patrons, old followers. There's this, beautiful, large community that keeps evolving and forming. And so I wanted to thank you for giving your time with us. And I love all of these familiar and new faces on these live sessions. So, and because of these fantastic episodes, we got a review on our podcast from the Netherlands. And this review is from, I can't pronounce the name, but it's Shazers. And it says, I've had the privilege of following this podcast since some of the first episodes. This is my go-to share when people want to learn more about Ukrainian experiences and culture. These powerful anti-colonial and queer exchanges are quintessentially Ukrainian and at the same time speak to current needs for paradigm shifting across the globe. Powerful collaborations as well. I mean, that is so moving, and I love that people feel like we are a safe space for not just Ukrainians and not just about Ukrainians, but for everyone to kind of learn and feel like they're sharing a coffee and a chat with a friend. So,
yeah, thank you, Tatiana. Anyhow, guys, I think this is all time we have. Thank you so much again for Alexandra. Thank you so much for
Absolutely.
Our amazing team, Valeria, Tatiana, Solomia. Love you guys so much. And thank you so much for, pulling this collective effort and making this show happen again.
And so grateful to Alexandra for meeting us in semi-real life in this space as well. We've been following you for a while, but it's been really amazing to hear from you as well. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
And if you guys are listening it as a podcast, please review and rate it at the end. This will help a lot. And if you're not still a patron, but you loved this episode, please consider joining our Patreon fam. You can find all the information at ukrainianspaces.com. That's all for now. Apart from one thing is Slava Ukraini.
Rom Slava.
Rom Slava.
Bye, everyone.